Our roundtable discussion on the President's State Department speech and its greater implications on Middle East policy. Here to talk about the wider implication of these issues are two experts who have been closely watching the region. Richard Strauss is the editor of the Middle East Policy Survey and a consultant on the Middle East. Also joining us is Asif Romirowski, adjunct scholar at the Foundation for Defense for Democracies and an adjunct fellow at the Middle East Forum. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The big news out of yesterday was President Obama's call to have Israel move its border back to where it existed in 1967. Here's President Obama.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states.
Richard Strauss, let's start with you. This was an unexpected policy change for the White House. Why do you think President Obama chose to go in this direction?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a major policy change. It's long been the case, certainly since the Camp David failed Camp David summit in 2000, that a solution that would be found between the Palestinians and Israelis would be based on border swaps, land swaps. And that the 67 border is the point at which you look at, and then Israel takes some from the West Bank and in exchange would offer parts of pre-67 Israel to the Palestinians, so it would be made whole in terms of a 100% aftermath. So I think the fact that that's been out there for more than a decade and been the subject of negotiations by successive Israeli prime ministers means that it hasn't changed. Now, the current prime minister, Netanyahu, has not accepted that, and his party has not. So in a sense that the president, President Obama, has presented it to a man who has not accepted it, acknowledged it, is somewhat confrontational, but it doesn't mean that it's different from American policy in the past.
But you did write in your survey, perhaps the most damning criticism of the Obama approach to the ongoing crisis in the Middle East is its absence of realism. Can you elaborate?
Well, I think what you're finding with the president is not just on this specific issue, although I think it is also apparent in this issue, is that there is a sort of idealistic view of what this president should be doing and what this administration should be doing, rather than kind of a realistic one. So it's idealistic to say that we're going to have these borders, but they have between the Palestinians and Israelis, but they have no plan to get there. It's idealistic to say that we are on the side of progressive forces, but we have no plan to get there, say, in Bahrain. But yet they want the president to be on the correct side of history. But you've got to have a plan. You have to be able to deal with each country in a different way, or in a specific way, and I see an absence of that in the way they've handled the situation almost from the very beginning in what's called the Arab Spring.
Also, Romirowski, I apologize for butchering your name, but Asif, you also used to serve in the Israeli army, and do you think President Obama's call for the changing of the moving of these borders, is this just a pipe dream, or is this really viable?
Well, realistically, I think that what we've seen over at least the few years since Hamas has come to power, I think that the modality of the two-state solution has kind of been, at least on the ground, really debunked. I mean, because what we're looking at today is the fact that we're actually at the basis of the things. We're looking basically at three states, basically the entities of Israel, the West Bank, and the mini-state of Hamas in Gaza. And what that does to the formation and really and how it changes the map, it really affects both Israeli foreign policy and American foreign policy. Both states declare that we don't negotiate with terrorist organizations. Again, and the fact of the matter is that no American official has gone to Gaza since Hamas has come about as the majority party of the Palestinian Legislative Council. What that means in practice is that, of course, aid to the Palestinian Authority today is questioned vis-a-vis how that money would be allocated as far as money to terrorism. All these latest reports that have come about the Palestinians being ready for statehood have been predicated on the idea that Salam Fayyad, the current prime minister in the West Bank, will remain in power. Those are the two reports that came out of the World Bank and the IMF. However, with this recent marriage between Hamas and Fatah, I'm quite skeptical about the fact whether or not actually Hamas will actually allow Fayyad to stay in power. So in practical terms, I think that this has changed the whole dynamic, not to mention the fact that Israel has put forth the idea that what they need for to maintain security of its citizens is something that is called defensible boundaries. Going back to 67 will not allow Israel to be allow it to defend its citizens in the way that it wants to and can and should, and that is part of the challenge of the language that came out of yesterday's speech. It's not to say that 67 has not been part of the negotiating discussions, but the way it was stated and those specific lines really do bolster the Palestinian narrative. And in practical terms, even the Palestinians understand, specifically the tension between Hamas and Fatah that existed up until now, that there's going to be great challenges, and this is not really a practical move forward, though it sounds good as far as a theoretical.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Voice of Russia. I'm Rob Sachs, along with Kim Brown, and we're talking about President Obama's State Department speech and its implications for the Middle East with Richard Strauss, editor of the Middle East Policy Survey, and Asif Romorowski, adjunct scholar at the Foundation for Defense for Democracies. Richard Strauss, I want to touch upon something Asif just brought up a minute ago, which is this marriage between Hamas and Fatah and the complications that causes for Western countries like the U.S. to deal directly with them. Hamas has stated that they are a terrorist organization, according to the United States, and they have stated they do not recognize the legitimacy of Israel. How then do you move forward with this potentially huge stumbling block?
Well, yeah, I think the administration does recognize that they have a problem there. As long as Hamas does not recognize Israel's right to exist, the United States is not going to be able to deal with it. I think the hope, certainly not the assumption, but the hope is that, like the PLO back in the late 1980s, Hamas will come around and will abandon that portion of its charter that calls for the elimination of the State of Israel. It's a hope at this point. It's not a whole lot more than that. I think in the meantime, what they expect, not more than hope, but expect, is that the Palestinian Authority, which does recognize Israel's right to exist and has been doing business with Israel in a variety of ways for a number of years, would continue to represent the Palestinians in any kind of talks. It's not going to be easy to pull that off, but that, I think, is what they're trying to do. They're trying to create a cabinet of technocrats. They're trying to continue to have Mahmoud Abbas, who is the head of the Palestinian Authority.
I can hear you.
Sorry? Don't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Strauss, but we actually just was joined on the line by Marwan Khalafani. He is the former senior advisor to Yasser Arafat. Good afternoon, Mr. Khalafani. Mr. Khalafani, can you hear us? Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Strauss, continue. We will...
No, I was just finishing up. I was just going to say that the idea here is to somehow keep Hamas at an arm's length and continue to do business with the Palestinian Authority. It's not going to be easy, but that is, I think the assumption here is that Hamas stays in the background and the Palestinians are represented by people who recognize Israel's right to exist. I don't say that the Israelis are going to accept that, but it'd be easier, particularly for the Europeans and perhaps even for the United States, to accept that formulation.
Well, one central issue is to what to do exactly with Jerusalem, where all sides want to claim that as their own. Now, Israel recently announced that it would be expanding housing in East Jerusalem, and that negotiations for dividing the city was off the table. But how do you see this as part of the dispute being resolved?
Jerusalem and the right of return for refugees are two of the hardest problems. I think one of the reasons the president has focused on borders is because of the three major issues. That's the easiest one, but only relatively speaking. I don't think people have a very simple or straightforward way of trying to deal with the Jerusalem issue. Both sides claim it. The Palestinians want East Jerusalem as their capital, and the Israelis want Jerusalem unified. There have been some attempts by previous Israeli prime ministers to figure out a way to have both. The Israelis have access to the full capital, and the Palestinians can have eastern side as their capital. It's a very tough issue, and nobody has a simple answer to it.
Well, I want to. I believe now we do have Marwan Kanafani, the former senior advisor to Yasser Arafat, on the line now. Mr. Kanafani? Hello? Sir? Still having trouble connecting to Mr. Kanafani, but I want to then pose that question to you, Asif Romirowski. What do you think about Jerusalem? Obviously, it's not only just a political discussion, but one that is wrought with a lot of emotion and people saying, "This is my homeland. This is my capital. This is the center of my religion." How then do you attack that issue and come to some sort of resolution with and kind of unraveling all these very deep emotional issues that are associated with dividing Jerusalem?
Well, for sure. I mean, the issue is always you can't deal with politics in the Middle East, specifically with the Arab-Israeli conflict, without understanding the theological correlation between politics and Jerusalem really is the nucleus as far as one of the core major obstacles as far as dealing with the issue. The fact is that under Israeli governance, Jerusalem has remained an open city and allowed for Christian Muslims and Jews to come and have access to the holy areas. The challenges and the fear on the Israeli side of things have to do with the fact that if it would come under Muslim or Arab control, then they would lose access to that. I mean, over the past few decades, you've seen even since the days of Yasser Arafat, there has been, namely actually when he met with then-President Bill Clinton, a flat-out denial that there was any kind of Jewish presence in Jerusalem, and only to minimize from Israeli presence in those areas. That's on the theoretical, theological, often, and clerics are very adamant about the fact that there has been ongoing denial for Jewish archaeological artifacts, and the fact that they even have any kind of connection between the city and the people themselves. From a practical standpoint, again, if you go back to the negotiations as far as 2000, when then Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Bill Clinton and Arafat met, there was a proposal that was met as far as having Jerusalem divided up and given it to the would then be the Palestinian state. The fact of the matter is Arafat even rejected that. There is a question, you know, pragmatically speaking, how do you even divide up Jerusalem? I mean, again, the city was divided pre-1967, and their idea that would be east and the west part of it. But from the Jewish narrative and from the Israeli side of it, that also prevents access to the Western Wall and the City of David and all the other holy Jewish sites that have been part of the core of what Jerusalem was all about. Not to mention the fact there's also a whole debate within Israeli politics about the unification of Jerusalem. Since 1980, there has been a law in the Israeli parliament which calls for Jerusalem a united city and the capital of the state of Israel. That has deep roots in Israeli politics. And as far as 67 is concerned, again, Jerusalem, this was part of the debacle that happened when then-Vice President Biden made his visit to Israel. There was a discussion whether or not Jerusalem was a settlement. Jerusalem was never a settlement. It was never part of a discussion vis-a-vis. It's a part of a settlement discussion, and as far as land swaps, that was part of the, I would say, the anger within Israeli society, especially amongst Netanyahu's government, that by opening up this kind of Pandora's box vis-a-vis 67, that although it wasn't discussed in particular terms, and though he stated clearly that Jerusalem refugees are going to be left to the final status negotiations, opening this up causes a lot of problems on the Israeli side. And you know, another point is worth mentioning, the last intifada, the Intifada al-Aqsa, was given a part of the excuse that it started had to do with Ariel Sharon's then Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the Temple Mount. I mean, there was a lot of anger going around these issues. But the main aspect, as far as Jerusalem goes, is we'll have free and open access to these holy sites. And from a demographic perspective, it's also important to understand that most of the residents of East Jerusalem are Arab Israelis. So in practical terms, those Arab Israelis are Arabs who are Israeli citizens, and they actually, if you, a latest poll that came out, they actually prefer life under Israeli governance than under any kind of Palestinian governance, given the corruption and the challenges that the Palestinian Authority faces, that they know they'll be treated fairly under Israeli governance.
Mr. Romanowski, I just want to jump in and let our listeners know they're listening to The Voice of Russia. I'm Rob Sachs, along with Kim Brown. So a lot was just said. We're speaking about the aftermath of President Obama's remarks yesterday at the State Department, particularly as it concerns the state of the Middle East peace process. And a lot was just said by Asaf Romirowski here about the state of Jerusalem and specifically how it may turn out, whether or not it can be divided up, and how it's functioned under Israel kind of overseeing all sides of the city. What is your response to that, sir?
Well, you know, Mr. Obama yesterday was the first American president to talk about the 1967 borders, that Israel should go back to the 1967 borders, but then talking about swapping land. And this is not a new issue, you know. Mr. Obama said that, you know, the Arabs and the Israelis should swap land for, you know, to compensate for the settlements that the Israelis are building on the West Bank. The fact is that even the swapping was tried before and it didn't work. I was part of the negotiations since inception, 1993. And the fact is that we never had a serious, honest-to-God peace process, because Israel, from the beginning, wanted to have peace and wanted also to have all the benefits that she got, you know, the land and Jerusalem and, you know, no refugees, and the water is also a problem. So nothing has changed since, and I'm sorry to say that. Nothing has been has changed since the beginning of the peace process. Mr. Obama was honest about talking about the sovereign Palestinian country and about the right of the Palestinians to have a homeland. And when it comes to how he is going to do that, that
has come
to the details.
Okay. Well, let's
is Jerusalem is one of the issues. I remember that I was the first Palestinian official who said that Jerusalem should be unified and a capital of two states. That was in 1994.
Okay, and, Mr. Kalafani, if you don't mind, one quick moment, sir.
It was not accepted by the Israelis because they think that the Palestinians, if they want peace, they should give everything else, including Jerusalem, including the right of the refugees to return, and including a sovereign Palestinian state. And it's not going to work that way.
All right.
If you want to have peace, you have to make both people on the two sides of the fence happy and content with this peace. And obviously, the Palestinians are not happy with what's taking place now.
Okay, our next question for Mr. Richard Strauss. We know you have to leave shortly, so let me ask you this this question.
I'm sorry, I can't read it.
Where exactly do we go from here, Mr. Strauss, as it relates to American intervention with trying to negotiate with the peace process between Israel and Palestine? Is it even feasible that America can have a significant role in this? It's been Obama, unfortunately, is the latest American president to get this accomplished. Prior to him, Mr. Bush had the Accords in Annapolis, and then prior to that, Bill Clinton had the Camp David Accords, and prior to that, we could just keep going back and back and back. Is it even logical or even reasonable at this point to expect that an American president is going to play an integral role in making peace between Israel and Palestine a success?
I can't think of a time in recent memory that the circumstances were as difficult. One is because you have an Arab Spring and all the things that are going on throughout the Arab world, which is makes changes occur almost daily. And if for no other reason, it makes an Israeli society and Israeli government quite uncomfortable about taking chances. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that you have on the Palestinian side, and I think also on the Israeli side, you have leadership that is not really willing or able to make the kind of deal that's necessary. I think the real truth is that George Mitchell has left his job, not that President Obama has given a speech. There is no route. There's no map. There's no road that we can see going forward and anywhere in the near future that is going to improve the situation. I think the problem the president has, and I'll try to say it quickly, the problem the president has is that he's under a lot of pressure from the outside world, not from inside the United States, but from the outside world, not just from the Arab world, not just from the third world, but also from the Europeans. There's a tremendous amount of pressure this president, the Secretary of State, feel from our allies, friends, and others around the world to do something. And they are trying to react and prevent perhaps some other things from happening, such as the Palestinians going to the United Nations and asking the United Nations to declare that they are a state. And that would be something the United States would have to try and prevent. So I think to a very large extent what the administration is doing now is not really trying to promote peace, but trying to stop the process from getting worse.
Okay, that was Richard Strauss. He's the editor of the Middle East Policy Survey. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Bye now.
And thank you also to Asaf Romirowski, adjunct scholar at the Foundation for Defense for Democracies and adjunct fellow at the Middle East Forum. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we're going to continue the conversation now with Marwan Kanafani, the senior former advisor, the former senior advisor to Yasser Arafat. Mr. Kanafani, we wanted to talk a little bit about the larger implications of this Arab Spring, what's being called the Arab Spring. What did you see as being the spark and the catalyst for what's happening here, and how do you think that this time, this year, has been different from so many other years in that you've seen so many people coming together and protesting against the government all throughout the Arab world?
Well, you know, what's happening in the Arab world now, you know, most of the Arab world is very encouraging and healthy. The peoples of the Middle East are not subject again to all kind of, dictatorships that took place in this part of the world for many, many, many years. And what's good about that the people of Egypt, let's say, or Tunisia, or, you know, the other states that they have a kind of a civil revolution, do stand closely with the principles that the Palestinian issue should be solved in a way that is fair and just and long-lasting.
Okay, that's Mr. Kanafani. He is a former senior advisor to Yasser Arafat, and on the line joining us now is Mr. Lawrence Korb. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He is also a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. Mr. Korb, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Now, of course, the first half of 2011 has begun with a lot of social and political turbulence, especially within the Middle East and North Africa. And with two heads of state already deposed and others facing strong resistance within their own countries and from the international community, the destabilization of this region just continues to unfold. So, gentlemen, let's start with Libya. Muammar Gaddafi continues to fight with the so-called rebels. Ground has been gained and lost repeatedly on both sides. And Mr. Gaddafi, he just recently buried his son and his grandchildren. They were killed in a NATO-led airstrike on Tripoli. Mr. Korb, is Muammar Gaddafi ready to abdicate power and end this conflict?
Well, I think time is not on his side. I mean, some of his ministers are defecting, and, the fact of the matter is that eventually his financial resources are going to dry up. He won't be able to pay a lot of those mercenaries he's using to fight. And I think the NATO, airstrikes are becoming, hitting closer and closer to home here. So I do think that if the NATO is patient, that eventually Gaddafi will leave one way or the other.
Now, Mr. Korb, you did mention his resources perhaps not being endless. The Swiss government recently announced that they have frozen roughly $400 million of the Libyan leader's assets. Does he have the resources to keep this fight going? And, I mean, can he even win?
No, not much longer. In fact, the United States alone has frozen $33 billion in his resources. And I think that's exactly what you're trying to do, is get him to see that he can prevail and then work out some way where he can abdicate power and do this in a way that minimizes the casualties on both sides. And he's being pressured, I think, by some other members of the Arab League. So, yeah, eventually I think if we're patient, this strategy will pay off.
Well, what about the strategy? I mean, we've always had here in the United States, the notion that we don't assassinate heads of state, but we've already seen NATO strikes go directly towards Gaddafi and almost get him. It seems like we're almost tiptoeing along this line of, if he happens to be in the line of fire, so be it, but we're not expressly going out to assassinate him. What is the stance on the Obama administration on perhaps taking out Gaddafi, or perhaps seeing the uprisings in Libya take him over?
Well, I think, and it's obvious, it's because the operation is being run by NATO now, as the NATO commanders have said. They're going after the headquarters that run the operation, that are killing innocent civilians. They're not targeting him directly. But, I mean, if you have a situation room in the place where he lives and he's directing the operation, then you're going to see, possibly he or some of his top leaders killed. And I think that's the difference. I mean, we're not sending in the CIA to kill him or anything like that, which would be against American law.
Mr. Canafani, if you're still with us on the line, and as regards to Mr. Gaddafi in Libya, how is his resistance both on the side of the so-called rebels and his determination to remain in power? How is that playing out amongst other nations in the region? What are others' perception of this conflict?
Well, I didn't hear your question well, but
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Canafani. Yeah. I said that, how is this playing, how is the Libyan conflict with...
If you guys want to go in, go ahead.
With Mr. Gaddafi trying to stay in power, and then the so-called rebels, with their assistance that they're getting from NATO, how is this playing out amongst other nations in the region? How is this being perceived?
Well, I think there are two sides of the story. The first side is that everybody is with the principle of protecting the civilians. This is a sacred job, and everybody is happy that it's being done in a way that more civilians are not being killed. But on the other hand, there is unanimous feeling among all the Arabs that that should not escalate to be an invasion, and secondly, it should not be escalated to kill civilians on your own too. So I think there's a delicate line there between what should be done politically mostly and economically, and what should not be done, by the raids, the military raids, and by the foreign invasion.
So, Mr. Canafani, do you feel that when we want to kind of move along too and see that all these things are going on, not just of course in Libya, but also in Syria, where we had President Bashar al-Assad, who's remained strident in his efforts to quell the massive protests against his rule. Now, President Obama here addressed that in his speech at the State Department yesterday. Here's what he had to say. And he went on to further elaborate on what he was saying. Here's a little part of that.
I can't hear you.
I was just going on to say that President Obama elaborated specifically on and had a message directly for President Bashar al-Assad.
Well, you know, I think that President Obama is right when he talks about democracy in the Middle East, and people should be giving their God-given rights. On the other hand, again, with or without Mr. Obama, the people of the area want to be free, and they have proven, you know, for the last, you know, few months that they are willing to do everything.
Look at this guy. He can't trust that well.
Hello.
Hello. Yes. All right. Let's go now to Mr. Korb. Mr. Korb, President Obama announced economic sanctions on Syria the day before giving this speech. What are the extent of these sanctions, and are they likely to have an impact on President al-Assad and his aggressive actions towards his own people?
Well, they'll have some impact, but they're not going to be a defining thing because, unlike the sanctions on Libya, we didn't, or Iran, you didn't get the whole international community. You couldn't get a UN resolution because of opposition, particularly from China and Russia. But I think it's basically the United States saying we've got to do something. We can't just stand by here. And then, of course, the president followed it up yesterday saying, you know, basically, you know, work with these people or get out of the way. And I think that was a very, very strong statement. But again, there's only so much the United States can do. I mean, we can't force him out, you know, by ourselves. But I think we've got to send the message that you stay in, you're going to be in an international pariah.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Korb, because there is a UN Security Council resolution on Syria. It's on the table now. Now, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, he said he would not back it. Let's listen to the Russian president.
I will not support resolutions on Syria. Frankly speaking, they were disregarded by the actions that some states took. Even though initially Russia supported the first resolution and didn't veto the second, what happened afterwards demonstrated that these kinds of resolutions can be manipulated. This is deplorable because it undermines the authority of the UN.
Were you able to hear that, sir?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well, basically, Dmitry Medvedev was talking about the actions of wanting a solution where you're not directly going against al-Bashir in terms of these actions. What's your reaction to that?
Well, again, I think basically given what Assad has done, the international community should be outraged that somebody would, you know, treat his own people like that. And, you know, I hope that the Russians, you know, basically realize that they don't want to set this as a new standard of international behavior, and there's got to be some price paid for it. Listen, I've got to run myself here, so it was good talking to you guys. Take care.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Larry Korb, then, is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for your insight and for joining us today.
Well, as we wrap up our roundtable discussion this afternoon, it's just very clear that the resolution, attempted resolution put forward by President Obama in his speech to the State Department yesterday, especially regarding the border, the redrawing of the borders or the possible reissuing them to status of 1967, is not necessarily playing well on either side between Israel or Palestine. President Netanyahu has already had a pretty frosty response to this suggestion by President Obama, and we heard some of the Palestinian remarks earlier just now.